You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today to talk about the recent book Dual Citizens from Lexham Press, dealing with the question of just how Christians should engage with politics and the culture, especially through the filter of Christianity Today magazine, is the editor of that book, Dr. Timothy Padgett. Dr. Padgett is the managing editor of Breakpoint.org at the Colson Center, lives in Colorado Springs with his wife and four kids, and is also the author of Swords and Plowshares, which deals with American evangelicals and war in the middle of the 20th century. Dr. Padgett, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to come on. It's always interesting with things like this. People ask you, well, would you willing to talk about this? I mean, when you spend weeks and months trying to produce, you know, studying something like this, well, twist my arm. Of course, I'll come and talk about it. It is a joy. And with talking about Christianity and politics is always interesting because it's such an easy, non-controversial subject, particularly in the last few years. Exactly. Right.
Right, right. Well, and it's easy to talk about because it's an excellent volume. And again, we should clarify that this is not original writing from you. This is a collection of editorials. Is right. These are all editorials.
Right. Well, no, they're not all editorials. What it is Lexham Approach. They're doing a series of books on Christianity Today's archive material. So they did one that I think focused on Carl Henry, obviously. Yep. Such a big figure, such a giant of a man, such a faith. And then also some more on more systematic issues. And they asked me, since some of my previous work had dealt with magazines and politics, they had asked me to come to kind of curate Christianity Today's articles. Dealing with politics. Now, that is such a wide-ranging project. There's so many things that might fit into there. And I think I mentioned in the introduction I had 6,000 pages, I think, of cut-and-pasted articles from 1956 to 2016. Many of them, and I would say probably most of them, are editorials, but not all of them. So, many of them would be by Carl Henry and those who come after. But many of them are more news stories. And that is in itself, I mean, an editorial is an opinion piece directly, obviously, but there is a bit of an opinion aspect to even a news story, what sure. someone chooses to focus on. I think as we were discussing earlier, from my MA thesis, I dealt with several other Christian magazines, and it was interesting to see how different magazines would choose what to talk about, because they're all covering the same events, but what they choose to describe, it becomes very different. The emphasis they put, they may choose two events, both of which happened, but each outlet, each magazine, chooses one thing which they think represents the key thing going on there. And that's so much of what political discussion is. It's not necessarily a differing opinion, but a different focus. One person says the key issue is the corruptions of American capitalism. Another says that the key issue is the virtue of American capitalism. And each is going to do, like a Sojourners is going to do a very different take on the same story than a Christianity Today. And it's right. So yes, what I did is I went through all those articles, and I could have written a book on each of the different subjects, each of the different five chapters. And so I selected for the five chapters covering U.S. presidents, foreign policy, evangelicals, kind of evangelical left, religious right, church and state issues, and kind of domestic political issues. Trying to categorize them by them. So many things were on the cutting room floor, so to speak. So many sure. articles that could have been discussed. They were great. Look them up there. Lexham has a great source for that. But this is trying to be representative of all the sorts of discussions that occurred.
Well, let's just walk through some of these sections. Now, the longest section in the book is the section on the presidents. So based on nearly seven decades of Christianity Today articles, ranging from the Eisenhower administration to the Trump administration, what should Christians be looking for in terms of their relationship with the president? either voting for or against a candidate, or even once the president's in office? What should we take away from this as believers?
Goodness, well, that's an easy question to answer very smoothly, right?
And no, just a couple minutes, too.
Yeah, exactly. What you do see in there, I think that for nearly every occurrence that Christianity Today did, I think they did a very good job of not being above the fray, but to having a perspective that's above the fray. That is that they could account to the virtue of various leaders without necessarily ignoring the failings or unnecessarily highlighting certain failings. So they had a fairly positive view of President Eisenhower. And he was another giant of a man. The guy liberated Europe from the Nazis. That's a great pedigree even before he becomes president of the United States. And then they move through, and some of them, they're much less interested in what the person is doing. Johnson, it was very interesting when they talked about President Johnson, it was almost the sympathetic, but almost condescending view, almost like he was trapped in his own circumstances. And so, you know, what you see that as they go back and forth through the various presidents, what is it that we should see as Christians? Well, that again is a tough thing. We're looking for someone, obviously, who is not going to be, you know, I guess it's not going to be the Antichrist, but he's also not going to be the second coming. And realizing that, I think that's the hard thing for us as Christians. We so want to sacralize. There's such an easy tendency for any American, and I think particularly for Christians sometimes, to sacralize the presidency as though it is a much holier office than it actually is. And so we can end up having great expectations over these men who are just fallen men, or one of these days, fallen women. These are people made in the image of God with all their virtues, and these are sinners, you know, after Adam and their failings. So what do we look for? We look for someone who maintains the peace. And that depends on what your view of government is. If you're someone who is looking to the government to bring in the kingdom, and that can be bring in the kingdom on the conservative end of things, emphasizing sexual morality or, you know, personal sins, things like that, or someone on the left end of things, someone who's going to bring in social justice issues. If you're looking for the president to bring that in, or any role of the government, you're going to be very disappointed. So I think part of it is having limited expectations, recognizing that this is going to be someone who's not going to get it right. They're going to fail. On the other hand, we should have some expectations. We should feel that they should live out the role that the Romans 13, that to preserve order, and the bit in Peter about the role of the state to keep the peace. God has called these people to do something. So what should they do? We should look to what the Bible calls them to do. And you see, when Paul is talking about the Roman government, it is a government that is flawed and corrupt, but it's keeping the peace after a fashion in its own flawed way. So we should keeping that, neither seeing this as, you know, a sacralized holy office. This is not a king. This is not David's line. But on the other hand, not seeing it as a nothing thing. So it is very hard to find that balance there of following basic Christian virtues while not necessarily seeing these people as Christians.
If we can, this is a little outside of the scope of the volume, which sure. Stops in 2016, right, mm-hmm. right with Donald Trump. But I think it's still relevant as a use of the book. Mm-hmm. We've seen something of a split in the evangelical world in the past 5 years, mm-hmm. somewhat because of Trump, but mm-hmm. probably along pre-existing fault lines with right. the rank and file of evangelicals continuing to hold fast to the Republican Party mm-hmm. and to Donald Trump, but a large number of prominent evangelical intellectuals breaking with the party, again, largely over Trump, right. and maybe not embracing the Democrats or the left,
right.
But at least marching out of step with the bulk of the church. Is that something new since 2016, or do we see something like that throughout the volume? Do we see a disconnect between what's in the editorials of Christianity Today about the presidency and what the average Christian reader would have thought?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And I think that, the short answer is there's continuity and discontinuity. One thing you see in the political treatment, political commentary in CT, and even some of these other magazines I've studied, but CT does a really good job in this, is that in the 1950s and 1960s, I wouldn't say they're nonpartisan. They're generally speaking, they're conservatives. And they, generally speaking, voted Republican, But again, I think part of it, so in one sense, I suppose, let me back up a second. One sense, part of the problem is issues within the within Christianity, but also it's issues within American politics. And so I think both of those things within American politics, that's a, in one sense, the simplest thing to analyze. There has been this great split in the country where to be a Republican is a completely mutually exclusive thing to being a Democrat. You used to have people, the center is gone. You know, you don't have people, you don't have Mark Hatfields anymore who come along and can be a left of center Republican. And you don't have right of center Democrats. It's much of more of a rare thing. What you do see in the 50s and 60s with Christians, when you look at people like Carl Henry, when you look at Francis Schaeffer and people like that, these are people who could have their, could be broadly speaking pro-American, whether it's foreign policy, broadly speaking pro-capitalism, broadly speaking all these sorts of things, but be quite willing to offer not just mild critiques, but staunch rebukes of certain elements of Christian society. And actually, I just presented it at the Evangelical Theological Society, and I dealt with some of these issues in the 1970s. And you do see in the 70s this split. Interestingly enough, I remember, I forgot which magazine it was, something noted that the first political action group by self-described evangelicals wasn't for the Republicans. It was for McGovern in 72. and so you do, I think you do in the 1970s, you see that split, this kind of bifurcation of the movement. Where evangelicals stop seeing, being willing to, or even Christians as a whole, but evangelicals in particular, while they're majority going to the Republicans, that's a change. So I think it begins then, and I think it's really become exacerbated now. But if you think about this, 1976, what was it? It was at Newsweek, I think, the year of the evangelical. Well, who are they talking about?
Jimmy Carter.
Exactly. They're talking Jimmy Carter. 4 years later, they've switched. So I think you see a general conservatism in the 50s and 60s. You see a beginning of the bifurcation between evangelical left, you know, the Ron Siders and Jim Wallisters are coming along, and then you're having eventually what becomes the moral majority. But it's almost like there's this third group that's still around, you know, the Carl Henrys of the world who are in between there. Yeah, I'm a good Presbyterian, but Carl Henry, he was the man. you know, nobody's perfect. He's a Baptist. And then eventually, I think in 1980, you see a big split as so many Republicans break for, so many evangelicals break for the Republicans with Ronald Reagan, with the abortion issue animating that significantly. Now, people talk about the issue that when do political conservative political action groups begin to be formed in the 70s, and they connect it to integration. And I think that's a fair statement. I think that's in some sense overblown. Because you really do begin to, I mean, you read through CT, they were talking about abortion before Roe v. Wade. They were talking about issues of human dignity before that became a thing. And so I think that you get, abortion drives it. I think that something else that drives it is Vietnam and the civil rights movement. Because I think that many people who became the political left within evangelicalism, they rightly looked at the either the passivity or the being accomplices on segregation and racist policies. They saw that and they rightly rebuked the evangelical church for that. You also had people who ended up in the conservative end of things. They looked at some of the things about how many mainline churches, here's a good thing. Evangelical left wasn't exactly soft on communism, wasn't soft on the tyranny, but some people in the conservative end of things could look and see, you know, the communists, they're killing tens of millions of people, and you're not as loud about that as you are about American feelings. And so I think it begins to split there. And then I think with the 90s, it's like you read through some descriptions of, you know, the first President Bush, and then you have with President Clinton and such a lightning rod, and eventually the election in 2000, that really split things as well. So it's kind of like a snowball. It starts back there. It's really there all the way back to, say, 1970 or so, but it just becomes even more accentuated as time goes on due to internal struggles and external circumstances.
Yeah, and I want to get to some of the issues that you brought up there, but one more presidency question, just because it's an election year. If the only thing I knew about U.S. presidents was what I read in this book, these selections from Christianity Today, who between Eisenhower and Trump, you know, in the stretch of presidents in there, who would I come away thinking that guy was really the best president?
Well, I suppose it depends what you're asking. Are you asking what you would think would be the best guy, or what Christianity Today thinks is the best guy?
Either one. Right?
Yeah. I would say the one that Christianity Today was the most unabashedly supportive of was George W. Bush.
Okay.
A lot of that has to do with him. He was, in one sense, much more open with his, what's a key thing of evangelicals? Conversionism. Right. He was much more open about his sense of conversion. He was very open about his pro-life credentials. But you cannot ignore 9/11 in that. That was such a moment where this was someone that, I don't think many of us thought before 9/11 that he was going to step up in that way. And he was able to put voice. He got bipartisan praise for his reaction, steadfastness. That famous scene of him standing in the rubble with all his construction workers. That's probably the one that they're the most supportive of. But there was so much emotion going on in there. But even I didn't include all the ones with him, but there was some disappointment in some of the other articles as well, because he might have been a staunch pro-lifer. He might have been staunch evangelical in all sorts of ways, but there wasn't the payout in some senses. And so there was a sense of disappointment. Who else is in there? Eisenhower is such a titanic figure. I remember when I was in college doing some studies, I did a paper on him talking about he was the one person in all the people we studied that he would have been in history books had he never been president. And it's hard to to differentiate the myth from the man in that. The Eisenhower he's got this gravitas, he's got this dignity, he's got this credibility. So he is this great figure. So I would say that with Bush comes away, Bush W, the second that is, comes away with the strongest positive emotions, but he also has the negative down things as well. Whereas Eisenhower was not a flawless man for sure, but he has this aura about him. So it depends exactly what you're getting at there.
Yeah, the more I learn about Eisenhower, the more I am impressed with him. I know my grandfather, mm-hmm. he was Eisenhower's guy.
Right, yeah. He was
postmaster in rural Montana, was totally dedicated to Eisenhower as president.
I've thought about one of these days, I would maybe do like a theological biography of Eisenhower, something like We Like Ike, evangelicals or something like that. And I think that'd be fascinating to do. I don't know if I have time, but that'd be a fascinating study because his pastor and former chaplain during the military was Edward is his name, who was an interesting figure himself, who was in the National Association of Evangelicals and I think in the National Council of Churches. And so like bridging this gap of this world, and he got a lot of, Eisenhower was an intriguing figure for sure.
Sure. Also relevant to Eisenhower, we should move on to a different section. There's a long chapter on the nuclear bomb, Vietnam, and communism in general. Is this of any more than just historical interest to Christians today? Is this something we should be reading through and saying, yeah. Obviously, nuclear weapons still exist.
Right.
And there is still communism in the world, and not just in, Bernie Sanders' mind. But some of that has sort of a quaintly archaic feel. I kind of picture people ducking under the desk, something I never had to do.
Yeah.
What are we to take away from that chapter?
I think this is a great question. Interesting. I saw an editorial cartoon. It was it said Cold War reenactors, and it was these middle-aged people hiding under their desks to be Cold War reenactors. And you wonder about the efficacy of that. It's not if you get hit by a nuke. We live a few miles from Cheyenne Mountain here. Yep. And if there's a nuclear war, we are basically glowing very soon. It's very interesting. One thing to bring out about each of those issues is, in one sense, we don't have to worry about this titanic nuclear exchange that we once did. Maybe one day we will again. God forbid that we ever do. But I think that understanding, I think there is an element where it is not simply, but significantly a historic question. Because when you look at evangelical reactions to the bomb, we in our day forget what a big deal that was. In my previous book, I dealt with some of the other reactions to the bomb. Some of these guys very quickly understood what had happened. They had this Pandora's box reaction. It was like, literally, thank God the war is over, that we are able to, the boys can come home. We're at peace with Japan finally. But oh my goodness, what have we done? There was definitely that attitude. And I think we forget, and you see this in conservative, center-right groups like CT, more conservative ones like Presbyterian Journal or Sojourners on the left. It was a big deal. from 1945 to say, well, 1989. That was a huge thing. I think more than historically, it shows, I mean, nuclear weapons, it's almost like COVID in the sense that we have been forced to face our own mortality this year in a way we have not before. It's not that we didn't think we were mortal before. It's just we've had been forced to face it. And I think that nuclear weapons provided this in-your-face, intense reaction that at any moment, the war could start over any sort of misunderstanding or actual intention, and everybody dies. Maybe not everybody, but we're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of people dead. So I think that as a statement of how Christians react to their own mortality, I think it is significant. When it comes to communism, I think it's a very interesting thing because I think often you say, oh, you know, those paranoid people back in the, you know, back in the 50s, they thought the communists were going to try to take over the world. Isn't that silly? Well, do you know where they got the idea that they were going to try and take over the world? From Moscow. I mean, it wasn't like, I mean, it's the old joke of, you know, you might be paranoid, but they are still out to get you or something, whatever the phrase is. I mean, they literally were trying to take over the world and were quite willing to use force to do so. So in that sense, there's a historical element in the sense that understanding why people, even the extremists, understanding why they were so paranoid, well, they weren't entirely paranoid. There really was a group of people who had, I remember reading a Billy Graham article, I was thinking this is CT, a little bit earlier than, I don't think it made it into this this book, but talking about how a small group of men in 1917, and now it's, what, a third of the world. And so I think that understanding, putting ourselves in those shoes, and another element that's both historical and present day, is that communism for many of these writers, it was not merely a rival political theory. It was a false faith. I mean, it is complete with an eschaton. It has saints and holy books and martyrs. It has all of these things. It wasn't merely like a monarchy that's a rival. This was an all-encompassing worldview. So when these men, usually men, were writing about communism, they weren't saying, we don't agree with their particular policy. They weren't opposing the United States with communism. They were opposing Christianity and communism. It just happened to be that the United States was the opponent of communism. So in that sense, it's historical. But I think that we have to see in communism or any of these kind of totalizing ideologies, whether on the right or the left, a totalizing ideology is not, in one sense, is not an option for Christians, because Christians cannot have a totalizing political ideology. And you can't have, it can't fit together where a secular totalitarian regime and Christianity, they're inevitably going to be enemies. They're inevitably going to be rivals. So I think that that's, whether that totalizing ideology is a cult of personality about this or that politician, or it's an ideology that's put forward, this is something that Christians can need to continue. It's not Christianity versus a political system. It's Christianity versus an idolatry, an overt idolatry.
Yeah, no, that's good. And again, that wasn't a criticism of the section. I thought it was excellent. No. But I'm also pretty anti-communist, so I've held on to
the whole 100 million people dead thing. Kind of, you know, turns me.
You know, yeah, I've held on to that aspect of fusionism right. From the old days of conservatism. To kind of shift gears into the domestic affairs mm-hmm. section. So it's made up entirely of two issues, right? Abortion and race. Is that a reflection of Christianity today over time, or is that what you thought? Those are still going ongoing issues, so let's go ahead and bring those forward.
Yes. I would say it's a bit of both. I would say with each of those issues, one, they're ongoing. I mean, the political dissensions in present day, the issues you mentioned before about the split within Christians, can be boiled down to those saying that human dignity in the form of abortion and euthanasia and things like that, as opposed to those emphasizing human dignity in the form of race relations. Those are the things that are animating so much of the passion today. So in that sense, yes, it is because those are still issues. And in one sense, I think that that's great because it's great and it is awful. It's great because, yeah, those are big issues. Those matter. It's awful because they're not mutually exclusive. The reason that we as Christians need to champion human dignity when dealing with abortion, and the reason we need to champion human dignity when it comes to the dignity of every member of Adam's family tree, it's precisely the same. These are human beings made in the image of God who don't gain their dignity by their age or their ethnicity, but is simply conferred on them by God himself. And we need to fight for that. We may disagree over policy, but we need to maintain that each of these things is a vital issue. I don't like the term a gospel issue, because usually when we say, oh, that's a gospel issue, we mean what you're saying isn't important, but mine is important. And it's just a way to do that. But this is something that flows out of the foundational issues of the Bible. You can't be a faithful follower of the principles of the Bible. I'm not going to say you can't be a Christian, but I'm saying you can't be a faithful follower of the principles of the Bible and insist on a radical pro-choice mentality. I would say you cannot do that. There are, depending on what you mean by that. And you can't be satisfied with the situations which we saw in the historical sense and even present day senses as well, in a different context, and advocate segregation and things like that. So sure. just to qualify what I mean by that, by the pro-choice thing, is saying that it doesn't matter is an issue. If you want to say the best way forward is not through legislation, that's a different question. That's a policy question. And right. that's a room for debate thing.
Or it's not the government's job to regulate.
Yeah, it's a much more complicated issue in that. And in terms of the historical thing, those were the big issues.
Sure.
That was the big aside from communism, which is a foreign policy thing, when you look through the 1950s and 60s in CT, the moral issue that kept coming forward was the issue of race. Now, CT had a difficult issue with race because you had L. Nelson Bell, okay, one of my fellow Southerners, and his views on race were interesting. You don't see it so much in CT, but in some other places, his views on race, he opposed state-mandated segregation, but he also opposed state-mandated desegregation, which is to say he was at the very least in the accomplice category in some instances when it came to racial issues. But you also had, again, you had Carl Henry, Long Island, good Yankee boy. And that's very interesting to see the different perspective, the cultural, what's in the water. You know, you don't know what's in the water being a Southerner, being a Northerner at the time. And they did talk about race. And there were some issues in some other magazines, good Christian magazines, and some of their statements were awful, absolutely awful. CT did not do a perfect job, but they did a pretty good job. Particularly, they did a good job. Actually, I remember a couple of years ago, I presented at ATS about this sort of issue and race. And one thing I noted is if it were 2016, I think it was when I presented this. And I said, if it's 2016 and a white pastor gets up in his church and talks about the importance of racial equality, he gets lots of applause and maybe a few snide remarks. If you do that in 1955, 1956, that's a big deal. CT was doing that. And they were calling out the church on race, maybe not as perfectly as we would have wanted them to, but given the context, that's a big deal. And then when it comes to abortion, you do see, like I mentioned before, you do see CT talking about abortion. I forgot the earliest one I had in there, but it's like late 60s. Roe versus Wade doesn't come along until January of 73. And they were consistent about that. While they were trying to maintain a good bipartisan view when it came to President Obama, they did critique him on that issue. That was an issue they were consistent over. Those are the two animated moral issues of today and the two ones that animated many CT articles throughout this period.
And I think that leads into a question I wanted to ask you. So in 1980, to do kind of a deep dive into the volume, the editors of Christianity Today, and I don't know if that's code for Carl F. H. Henry or not, but the editors wrote that Christians should not be single issue voters.
Right.
This is in the Just Because Reagan Has Won. Now, it's at this point, we're instead of 7 years after Roe, we're almost 50 years after Roe.
Yeah.
Is that still true?
Yes. I think that, there's a bit of it's one of those yes and no issues. We cannot, as Christians, we need to watch our tactical versus our strategic compromises. I think that for many people who voted for President Trump this last time, well, the last two times around, there was a conscious tactical compromise. They saw in him something that they did not like at all. I had a friend who, this is 4 years ago, she sent me a text or called me and said, I just voted for Trump and I feel like throwing up. And you had people doing the exact same thing for Clinton 4 years ago and Biden this time around, who recognized that they were making a tactical compromise, that they recognized that embracing Biden now or Trump now meant getting politically in bed with some people and some ideas that they detested, but they saw it as their Christian duty to vote one way or the other. The problem, I think, comes when we begin to see it as to distinguish a strategic compromise and a tactical one, seeing that to vote on abortion, to vote for a pro-life candidate means I don't have to think about other issues. It means that I don't have to consider questions of immigration and what sort of, you know, prison reform, all sorts of things that evangelicals have always been very concerned about, that, or vice versa, that because someone found Trump or some other candidate in the past to be, you know, egregious in one way or the other, that means I don't have to be concerned about these other issues. That means getting it politically in bed with whatever party. And I think that that's the hard thing, is because I think we all know people who, I mean, I lived the last 2 years, I've lived in a state where it didn't matter who I voted for because it was very clear who was going to win that particular state. So I had a friend who voted for me 4 years ago just because he was like, I don't want to get involved with this. And I think it's one of those hard things, is like, how do we differentiate making knowledgeable political tactical compromises, balance that out with apathy? Because we can't not care. We can't not care about abortion. We can't not care about race. And we can't not care about whatever issue it is. So I don't think there's an easy solution on that. My where I get my, you know, dander up is when I see people saying, I understand people saying, I don't see how you could have done that, but I'm not going to doubt your faith or your integrity. What gets me angry is when people say, there's no way any Christian could have voted for this candidate for any reason whatsoever. There's lots of reasons not to vote for either of these candidates this last time around. And I think that's where we need to have some grace with one another, that it's not a clear-cut issue. And it's an odd thing, because you can almost say we can't go to the Bible for reference, because, you know, the Old Testament, it's a monarchy. You don't get to choose who's in charge of your own country. And then the New Testament, it's not only a monarchy, but it's a foreign imposed monarchy. It's an imperial system. So there isn't a direct way for us as Christians to see, well, how do they, it's not like Paul said, well, you know, I like Vespasian, but maybe, you know, Domitian's better. Anyway, I mean, they weren't concurrent, but you get my drift there. And so I think that it's the place there is when it's 1980 or it's 2016 or it's 1956 or whenever it is, we need to examine the issues, be as faithful as we can in the circumstance, acknowledging that whoever we vote for is not going to be, you know, saint whoever. This is going to be a flawed person. And in the last few years, I think this has been very hard for Christians to vote. Anyone who gets excited about voting for anyone in the last few years without any sort of regret, that's a problem, I think. It's a problem.
Yeah, you're maybe a little more generous than I am. I mean, certainly I agree that you could have voted in this election or in 2016,
right,
either party as a Christian, either candidate as a Christian, and had a clean conscience. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Can you unreservedly embrace either candidate, as some of our fellow believers, and I think they're probably believers, which then kind of leaves us in the position of, well, maybe they're just not that reflective. I'm not sure exactly how do you balance all of that out. So it's one thing to plug your nose and vote Trump, Biden, Trump, Clinton, whoever. Yeah. It's another thing to say, this is awesome, and this candidate is amazing, and this individual is fantastic.
Part of my role at the Colson Center is I field questions from people, questions and or complaints. And anytime we write anything in politics, I know my inbox is going to get very full. Sometimes over the same issue, people on different sides will be accusing us of all sorts of clear bias because of things. And it's for the same piece of thing that we wrote, and they have mutually exclusive things, the opinions about it. So I joke with people that one of my goals is to write something that's going to get me accused of being both a fascist and a Marxist for the same article. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but I think that I think that's a natural impulse for humans. We want to be clear that we know we've done right. I think it's a natural impulse in our world that is increasingly losing its sense of transcendence, losing its sense that there really is a knowable bigger picture out there, a bigger understanding, bigger world. And so we want to latch on to something that we don't have to have any questions about. And politics is not something where you can have no questions about. It's going to involve tactical compromises, maybe justified. Think World War II. In World War II, we signed up with one mustache totalitarian dictator to fight another mustache totalitarian dictator. We made the right call, but that meant teaming up with Joseph Stalin, who is arguably on his death toll worse. Not a worse human being, but in terms of what he managed to do, in terms of the awfulness, than what was Hitler. We're talking about awful people. When you're given a choice between two awful things, you sometimes have to choose you don't want to do the lesser of two evils, but sometimes you have to consider the wisdom of what is going to make the world better, not was this an expression of myself.
No, that's good. And that's actually maybe an okay place to round things out. Although, not directly related to the book, but because you work for the Colson Center, I guess mm-hmm. Chuck Colson does have some
yeah.
essays in here, mm-hmm. Which are excellent, by the way. I always appreciate reading him. I do have to ask, 2020 mm-hmm. election, what would Chuck Colson have done?
Oh goodness, I'll say no comment on that one. that is a hard one. I don't know. There's some other people who knew him personally and would perhaps be better able to speak into that. But you do see what I appreciate about Colson and Schaefer and Henry is there's this realism, principled realism.
Sure.
They have their principles about what needs to be done and how do we achieve that. But with Colson, you have someone who literally was in the throne room, so to speak, who he was in the corridors of power, unlike much of anyone who could speak about this. In fact, several years ago, before I came to work for the Colson Center, I was doing grad school, doing some research, and I was at Wheaton College, and they have Colson's papers there. And, they have the normal stipulations over, this is before he passed, they had normal stipulations about, not to be opened until someone dies, not until 25 years after he dies. But with him, it said not to be opened by order of U.S. Congress. Because he, unlike most people in church history, he had state secrets. And so that's an interesting aspect to that. So I think, again, what I think that I appreciate about them is that the principled realism to be able to understand that there are reasons we vote for what we do that are greater than this one political moment. But at the same time, to be to have a realistic approach to understand, we fight the fight, but it's not going to be a clean fight. One of the phrases we toss around the Colson Center is, the second coming's not going to come in. Some of the effect of the second coming's not coming in on Air Force One. We're not going to bring in the kingdom through a political means. And I think that that's what you see with political zealots on both sides of the board. Very often, here's another book project I'd like to work on, Christian statism. There's lots of talk, lots of recent books talking about Christian nationalism. And that's good. It's good to discuss those Christians who have conflated, the cross and the flag. That's a great discussion. But I think that we also need to have discussion about Christian statism, those who see the government's role of implementing godly measures. But these are people of the left who are doing this. And so I think that what we need to have is an acceptance of, the Christians need to seize the broad center. If the world around us has been moving to the extremes, it's an opportunity for Christians to move to the broad center, recognizing that we're not going to bring in everything that we want through judges or politicians or whatever, on whatever side it is. And I think that that's our great hope. So yeah, keep that principled realism that we see in Colson, that we see in Henry, and we see in these others, but move towards a higher perspective.
And there's something to be said for being the only sane people left in the room. I don't know that we can say that about ourselves, but that's that's a good goal to have, maybe.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to bring up? I've been sort of leading with the questions here. Is there anything you'd like to highlight out of the volume before we close out?
No, I think that with any sort of thing with history, anytime we do history, for some of us, we like history because we like history because we like history. I'm guessing from your bookshelf there, and you can't see mine, but it's right over here, that we would fit in that category. We're going to read it regardless. But I think that the virtue that studying history, in particular Christian history, brings to the church is not just antiquarian interest, but it's fundamentally humility. That when you read something like this, what I hope you get is not factoids, that's good, but understanding that these were people writing in their context, and they made mistakes, and they had perspective loss, but they also had some really good insights, and they had really good reactions to see not just where do they fail by seeing where they differ from us, but where do they succeed by being different from their own culture. I mean, that's something that we miss a lot in these things. And also we see that them not having the right perspective on something, and that should remind us that, well, we don't either. And I think that's one of the great temptations. It's the whole chronological snobbery thing that we have arrived. I remember I used to teach history to a college level. And one thing I would say is, I want you to feel free as to the students. I want you to feel free to look at the people 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 500 years ago, and offer critiques for what they got wrong. But I want you to remember, even as you do that, then in 50 years, in 100 years, in 500 years, your great-great so-and-sos, they're going to wonder at us, how could they have missed it? And I would tell my students, I want you to think of things what they're going to look back and see. They're not merely going to look back and see the things that we see are wrong. They're going to look back and see things as wrong, whether they're right or wrong about it. Things that we don't even notice. The unasked questions that we don't even see. And so that's what I see as the virtue of a book like this or any other history book, because it grants us the perspective that these were saints just like us and they were sinners just like us. And God's still on his throne in 1956 and 2016 and in 2020, no matter who you voted for.
Well, and that's a good place to close. So Dr. Padgett, thanks again so much for coming on the show. And
it's been a joy. I didn't want to get into your bookshelf there. So that's always envious of other people's bookshelves.
Oh, no, I understand. And if you get those other books written, send one my way and
I'll be back on. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway,